Hello and welcome to...
Can you say the name?
Yes!
Yes!
Okay, let me try to say the new name. Start Worrying, Details to Follow. This is the podcast that we used to call Anger Management.
Yeah, and you say we're not angry anymore?
I am angry. I am still angry. But I think it's important to move into a new phase.
And something changed. We started in the US with... everybody was still incredulous about this man in the White House.
Yes.
So it was a sense of urgency to... deal with that and to come up with people who have a clear vision.
Quick fixes.
Yeah.
To an urgent situation. And now we're moving into the more long-term project of changing structures, but even more so looking for new ideas.
Right. And the name is given to us. We had a dinner.
Yes.
With our friend Igor Levit, who's also the pianist, who also played the music for us at the beginning, the intro. So thank you, Igor, for the music, and thank you for
the name,
which I think he said it's the Jewish telegram, so the perpetual notion of threat.
And start worrying, I guess that's where we all are, but more importantly, details to follow. That's our promise to you as listeners. We will provide you with details of the new and of the future.
And also thanks with a new logo, which is bold and radical and bloody.
And red.
And red.
No, it's not bloody.
What's bloody? It has this machine.
It's not revolutionary.
It has the machine, the violent machine in the earth.
It has a very calm, reddish tone to it. Very constructive.
It's interesting that we say that.
It's constructive.
Yes?
Pragmatic red.
Okay.
It's not revolutionary
You
red.
Think it's social democratic, the logo?
No, I just like the nuance.
Okay, good. I mean, I as you can hear, it's both, which is also the theme of the podcast. It's both radical and coherent. That's what we are. Karin is coherent. I'm trying to be radical.
Yes.
So, for the first episode...
And you are?
I had the same idea that we should sort of introduce ourselves.
Yes.
Not everybody knows us, apparently, but I'm Georg Dietz.
I'm Karin Pettersson. I'm... from Sweden, Aftonbladet, and you work at Der Spiegel, no?
That's true.
Yes.
That's true.
So we're two Europeans trying to find our way, two lefty Europeans trying to find our way in this new world of disruption.
Is lefty a diminutive term? So
just trying to find a term that goes for both of us.
A left doesn't do it?
Lefty. I just like the...
Yeah?
Yeah, the sound, the melody of that. And we're also journalists.
I wonder about lefty.
Lofty ideas, journalists.
Yeah.
Anyway, our first guest in this new shape.
Yes.
Tell me.
It's Peter Pomerantsev. You brought him to the show, and I have to say it was a great find. He's a very, very engaging person to talk to, a very engaging mind he has. He's an expert in Russia, but you were interested in the propaganda aspect, digital.
Yeah, he's running a project at the London School of Economics with Anne Applebaum, whom we had on the podcast recently. And they're studying propaganda and how it influences politics and the public discourse. And he had this great take on, he knows everything about Putin. He used to live in Russia. He's an author, he's a journalist. And he had a new way of looking at politics as a carnival, void of meaning. When the left-right conflict sort of fades out, what we get instead are these populist clowns who are more entertainers than anything, which I thought was an interesting
It was. Take. So welcome to Start Worrying, Details to Follow, episode 1. Stick with us.
Here are the details.
Peter Pomerantsev, just to set the stage, as usually Karin and I are a little on different sides of the argument, and we might cover both. The question of digital threat to democracy, that's more Karin. The question of how to deal with the digital threat or how to use digital to reinvigorate democracy, that's maybe my side of the argument. You might choose if you want to start at the beginning or the end or the problem or solution, whatever it is. But you're an expert on both, how digital tools shape democracy and how digital tools might change democracy. You choose where you want to start.
Well, I'm not actually an expert. I'm more like somebody from, someone from the old world who understands words and film.
Like us.
And documentary. And suddenly...
That's a good perspective.
And
man.
Suddenly, like... You know, I feel like a Stefan Zweig character, you know, like this world that I knew is clearly changing. I mean, I used to work in very commercial TV and I thought I was very on the edge of things. And suddenly, like, this whole new language is emerging in the digital space. So partly this project is like Anne and I trying to, like, people from an old world where we knew the rules, trying to understand the new one. So what we're doing is engaging with experts. And our guess is that actually some magic will happen when we put together these data people who speak this slightly different language to us with our kind of old fading ideals about democracy and all those kind of things. And can we reinvigorate each other? So all the projects that we're doing or want to be doing kind of how can we use digital to sort of reinvigorate democracy? But we're not experts yet. We will be by the end.
But that's, I think, the important step, because the people that we talked to from the digital side, they were sort of always very clear about where they wanted to go, but they didn't really know why they did what they did. So they didn't have a clear understanding of democracies often, what it's about. And I guess that relationship between the old world and the new world is what is so needed, I guess, to as a corrective to reflect on the digital nature of democracy in the future.
Yeah, I mean, have you met? You probably meet a lot of Silicon Valley people, don't you?
Yeah.
See, I've only just started meeting with them, and they're clearly really, really good at data algorithms. I'm not sure any of them read a book ever, and it's actually shocking the level of kind of thinking that I've encountered. Now, that might just be my bad luck, and I hopefully spend a lot more time meeting those people, but I was a little bit shocked.
So, but
yes, there seems to be a few little sort of different camps that need to be sort of connected with each other.
So if you say you feel like a Stefan Zweig character in this, in a melancholic and sad way, looking back to the world that you're losing. So can you describe the world that you see? What is it that we're losing and where are we heading?
Well, listen, the troubling thing is that all the formula and ingredients that we thought we had that strengthens democracy, it turns out, can be completely upended. So when we're faced with a totalitarian regime, we know the plot. More freedom of information, transgression, they're stiff, we're life, we're the carnival, we're the Havel-like carnival, they're the sort of stiff authoritarians. But, okay, so I started to become aware that we need to start questioning a lot of these simplistic formula that we have when I was looking at sort of Eastern Europe and Russia, especially during the war in Ukraine. So, you know, take Odessa. Odessa is like a city that would have had two or three TV channels, or two TV channels during Soviet times, so the Black Sea port. Now it has over 90, plus all the digital stuff, over 100 ethnicities. And, you know, that actually doesn't necessarily mean that you have a better sort of Habermasian deliberative space. You just have fracture. People, when they're faced with so much information, can't really tell the difference between what's good and bad anymore and end up just going with what's just more emotional. So all these kind of very simplistic sort of formula that we had, like more information will lead to better democracy, it's a bit like sort of more free markets would lead to better economics. Like, no. Without kind of wiser use of the markets, and I think without wiser use of information, then it, you know, things just disintegrate. And I saw that sort of in focus groups that we did that I saw in the Baltics. So people there had seen, it's not as if they live in a closed information space. Yeah, they sort of had Russian propaganda, American propaganda, local propaganda, all coming at them. And in focus groups, they were quite honest. Like, they we assume the Russians are lying. We assume everybody's lying. So we just go with the one that kind of like, you know, is the most fun to watch or whatever. So you enter this sort of space where, like, there's so much information that people can't make rational and deliberative decisions anymore. And so what triumphs is this sort of utter spectacle, like Trump or someone.
Brexit. I mean, we were here in London,
yeah.
Which sort of the Brexit is based on presumably one lie. So the interesting point is, as you say, you've studied authoritarian regimes of the old mold, but what happens, Trump, or in this case, the 350 billion lie of Nigel Farage? So is that, what was that, where is that position lie, democracy, majority rule, sort of finding some common ground, some truth in how to proceed?
Well, it's going to be very, I mean, that's a challenge. That's why we've called our think tank Arena, because it's a place where people can come together and talk to each other again. But it's, there's another thing that comes with, so there's the overload of information, and sort of we get lost inside of that, and actually it doesn't benefit the best information. It benefits people who turn it into a spectacle. And that kind of relates to the other bit, which I find very interesting, which is sort of being transgressive was always something we actually associated with democracy in the 1960s. The Cold War, we had rock music and miniskirts, and they had, you know, whatever they had, but it was rubbish.
Not very long life.
Yeah, exactly.
For bread.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And like the 5-year plan. So freedom in all its various forms was celebrated. And the US sort of sponsored abstract expressionism and jazz and rock music, and the Beatles helped bring down the Berlin Wall, all that stuff. But now the other side used transgression much more. You know, Farage. Look at their humor. I mean, Boris Johnson, Trump, they're all about talking about sex and using swear words and being kind of the punkish, clownish characters, Milo Yiannopoulos. So they've, again, that was the other thing that democracy or that kind of liberal democracy is all about. Sort of lots of free information, lots of freedom, 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 and also sort of transgressive energy. And now they're using that much better than we use that. Now we're the stiff ones, you know. So with Brexit, there was a lot of it was about that as well. I mean, why were Farage and especially Johnson so important? You know, Johnson, who's the Pantagruel of English politics, overweight, drinking, proud of his, you know, flirtations with women. Farage makes bad jokes all the time. They were the naughty boys. They tapped into something very English as well, eccentricity. And the English love the idea that they're eccentric. And here are these two eccentric characters showing how different and transgressive and weird and Monty Python-like we are compared to boring, sort of like George Osborne lecturing us about money. It's like, fuck that. So it was very, very English. 350 million, did that swing it? I don't know. I always feel that maybe it did. Maybe that people were very receptive to that message for a lot of reasons.
Maybe, as you say, maybe it's just part of this bigger package. That's really interesting. That's a major shift, basically, in the way politics is perceived, or change is perceived. So change is associated with the spectacle, so with transgression, as you say. So and that is a larger trend then, that change is coming now iconoclastically or transgressively or destructively.
But it's
the establishment from the right.
Well, the right have leapt on it, but I think it starts a lot earlier. I mean, I always like, what's his name again? Borstein a lot, you know, the image. I think he gets it. I mean, the moment we move into TV, we move away from sort of like, you know, these sort of politicians who are very proud of their, you know, exceptional sort of rational debating skills to something that's much more about the image, which has its own logic, which isn't necessarily the logic of good policymaking. But it starts with Kennedy, and then you can see how it gets intense, intense, intense as the image, as images and then digital media starts to dominate us. But it's a trend that, you know, you can take it all the way from Kennedy and then through, you know, Berlusconi is really the most successful one in the 90s. Then Putin and Chavez, who was, you know, forget about how brilliant Chavez was. You know, he was doing talk shows that lasted like 5, 6, 7 hours. Yeah, well, he'd invite like Sean Penn on and a jazz band and fire a minister. I mean, he was pretty amazing at that. And then through Putin, who's a much more designed but, you know, very, very image fixated sort of president, and Trump is kind of the natural logical conclusion. So no, it's not new. It's been building and building and building, and it's kind of everything
but
up.
To take it together, add it up. What is it? What is that advanced democracy, as Erdogan calls it? Is that just a spectacle of characters? Is that like, is it a form of government already? Is it a regime form? I mean, what's developing in front of our eyes here?
Certainly not a form of government, because they don't tend to govern very well.
No, but
it's a form of campaigning.
Majority.
Yeah. So Chavez turned everything into endless campaigns. Chavez had, there's another thing, you know, elections are meant to be good for democracy. I mean, Chavez was having elections like every 6 months because he was constantly in campaign
fun
mode.
Also.
Huh?
Yeah, it's also fun.
It's fun. He had a financial advantage. Enemies. Yeah, exactly. Financial advantage. So this sort of style is very good for campaigning. It's terrible for governing. So Brexit can't govern. Brexit was great for the campaign. But when they have to actually do policies, like what? Trump can't do
same
policies.
With Trump, yeah.
And kind of Chavez had one policy, which is just like, you know.
Putin seems to be able to govern, though.
He had to stop at one point. So there was stuff that was just happening because Russia needed to develop. But not really, no. There was just a natural oil boom that went on for a long time. And kind of most ministries are run as discrete fiefdoms, so the militaries. It all depends on whoever's running it. No, he was quite hands off. He was he just kept a balance between all different groups. But there's just so much money in the system that there was enough to cover any cracks. The minute that he had to start governing was after the protests, when like there were political reforms he had to do, and his solution was to start a war because it was too complicated.
But would you say
please
that. The inability or the difficulty of the media to deal with Trump or with AfD in Germany or with any of those new phenomena has to do with that old set of instruments that you are sort of seeking for the highest for the highest maximum energy in the discourse, as you say, the spectacle. So you look, you don't even have any compass really what you want as media, but you have just sort of this the magnetism of going to the loudest source, and that's sort of the problem why in the US love CNN or NBC, so love even mainstream media was, or New York Times was high,
mesmerized by Trump.
Was mesmerized and manipulated by Trump. Mm-hmm. And the same similar stuff, I mean, on a large, smaller scale, you can see in Germany happening, and in Europe happening.
No, completely. Completely. That's I wonder how they sleep at night. No, it's completely, I mean, it's completely indulged his performance.
So could you talk about, the way that you described this, it goes back decades and it's just a kind of a natural progress of imagery, spectacle. But can you talk about the new thing that is social media and kind of this outrage machine that Facebook and social media companies have created? Does that play into this and how is that used? Is it something new or is it just... Is this a continuation of something old, or is it?
Well, everything's a continuation of something old, you know.
Yes.
In a way.
But is it a leap?
Radio was also just another form of communication, but it kind of transformed everything.
But it changed everything.
Yeah,
yes.
And so, and a military guy put it very well that you could actually describe airplanes and warfare before airplanes. There were other flying objects which launched missiles in warfare before airplanes arrived.
Yeah.
But kind of airplanes did kind of change things a little bit. So in a way, yes, we've always been messaging. So, you know, there's always been like... Yeah. So it's nothing new. I think what's new about... Well, so far we're fixated on the technical stuff. There's also an ideological crisis happening, which has come together with this. But the technical side... I don't know, I'm talking a lot to campaign managers. And I've never run a campaign, so I'm kind of... This is all very secondhand, but this is the picture I got. So the logic of social media has created what we're calling populism at the moment, or a very specific model of it.
Created, not just reinforced, but actually created.
It's created a specific one, yeah? So this is the way they... And I've talked to them in Mexico, here, America. It's the same picture that emerges. So you're doing a campaign now. You don't have to take the center. You don't have to take CNN, yeah? You want your leader to get airplay there, but it's not really about that. You want to hit all these different communities, all the different causes on Facebook, which are micro causes. Animal rights, parking rights, whatever, anything that people are inspired by. And you want to do completely different messaging to all of them. And you have to recreate your story for each one. And their interests can be fratricidal. They might actually hate each other. You just have to, because they won't see the advertising going to the other one.
That's the key, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that they won't see the messaging going to the other.
But you know that's changed this morning. Zuckerberg's banned dark ads.
Yes.
But still, they would still see it a lot less than in TV when everyone was watching more or less the same stuff. So you're selling yourself to completely different ways. So in order to then unite all these very different things, you can't have a strong kind of ideological backbone. even if there were one. What you need is something very, very vague to tie all these people together. So the people, the many, something as vague as possible.
But still emotional.
It just has to be, well, they're already emotionally engaged because you're actually accessing on the things they really, really care about. You know, that you're hitting their sweet spots. So they're already emotionally engaged. And you sold them yourselves in different ways. You use completely different advertising. You may have not used your candidate sometimes. Trump campaign didn't always use Trump and targeted ads. And then so in order to bring that together, you have to have some very amorphous idea of the people. And you have to give them the sense that you can solve all their various problems. And for that, the only thing really is an enemy. So the establishment, Hillary, the EU, which somehow, so the EU and the Brexit campaign became the cause of abuse of animal rights, immigration, whatever. Whatever your private worry was, that became the thing that, you know, you felt was blocking it. So at least this kind of very, very kind of like odd politics where... which is a populism, which isn't about the people being able to articulate common causes and saying what they're about. It's the opposite. You need the idea of the people because the people are so fractured. And that leads to a very specific kind of politics, which is seems to be very successful at campaigning, or has been very successful at campaigning. But can't govern by definition because you've sold yourself in such different ways. How are you then going to govern? So that seems to be a trend that we're sort of trapped inside, which seems to be generated by just the model of social media. The anger stuff, I mean, there's been a bit of research on it. There's a guy at University of Venice called Walter Quattrociocchi, who you should definitely interview. So he did sort of a test on looking at the emotional trends on Facebook, and they always go from positive to negative. Whatever, best to go and double check this afterwards. But you know, I'm sort of quoting an academic paper by heart, so it's a bit not very reliable. But basically, people get angry, is what he means. And he reckons it is because, and this is really just his interpretation, I don't think he can prove it, that people go online not to win an argument, not to sort of take part in some sort of discussion, but essentially as a small narcissism machine. You go there looking for likes and retweets.
Yes.
Self-confirmation. Mm. So you're not even looking for a real political discussion. You're looking for anything that makes you feel good and gets you adulation from people. A, that pushes you towards more extreme things to say because that tends to get more attention. By Trump. But also that can never really quite be satisfied because, like, it's like cocaine or something. Not that I would know, but the way it's explained. You know, you go there looking for that emotional hit. You can never quite get it. You get angry and angrier and angrier. Thus, he says, kittens are very popular on Facebook. Because kittens for a moment sort of relax that sense and they give you the sense that you've seen something small and weak that makes you feel good. So, that means that the discussion happening on Facebook, quite the opposite of being the sort of wonderful public space for deliberative decision making, is actually a place where, by its very nature, pushes towards polarization and people not listening to other people that in any way disagree with them, which is quite, I mean, that's quite bleak.
And it also, I guess, I mean, thinking about solutions or thinking about how this could be fixed, it's problematic because it also really goes to the core of the business model of these companies. They want, the whole idea of Facebook is for people to stay on their platform as long as possible. And if people do that, if they're emotionally, you know, upset or angry, then there is no simple fix to this, as in, you know, let's take away all the fake news. Because the attention economy in itself, I guess, is driving this, the whole incentives that built it.
But, I completely agree, but imagine you could use this sort of the data that it generates to bring people together. So let's say, Gilad Lotan has done quite a lot of research about Palestinian and Israeli groups on Twitter. And no, because it's so negative. Because, you know, Twitter was meant to be a positive experience, and actually,
that's what they promised.
Yeah, well,
connecting people.
Yes, well, exactly. And then, like, you can see the Palestinian and Israeli communities. So they used to be an overlay. They used to be bits where they talk like that. So yes, that would certainly indicate that. But imagine you could get, but you know, could we use that data positively? Is something that we want to ask here. So let's say you can get the data on the sort of, let's say, the pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel group, taking a really easy subject that's really easy to fix here. But you could then be able to tell what things they have in common. Could you then engage them in ways, you know, knowing these are the two things they have in common. Could you do that in real time? Could you have good bots that went around in the middle of every argument, sort of checking what do they have in common?
Happy bots.
Well, there are good bots. There are good bots. No, I'm not saying yes.
Not all bots are bad.
Yeah. Not all bots. There are some good redeemed bots. So it's hard, but can we use this data to bring people together? It's kind of what we want to experiment with here.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, like, the people who... whether it happens organically or whether somebody is dividing people on purpose, like, you know, these ads that were put out in the US election, a lot of them were about dividing people. They weren't about inspiring. So whether it's happening naturally or people doing it on purpose to sort of, like, you know, try to clash different groups together, can we use that same data for something positive? It's sort of...
can we? That's the answer. That's my answer.
Well, that's what we're going to experiment with here.
But...
is
okay.
that your answer?
That's
the answer I'm looking for.
I think we need like 18 months to find out. I mean, theoretically, why not? I mean, it's just like doing...
what do you mean 18 months? What happens in 18... oh, your research project.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's how long it takes.
I think you meant
12 months.
There was something else happening in 18 months.
Right. Yeah, no. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, maybe quicker. Maybe we'll know quicker. But theoretically, well, I really want to find out. So theoretically, why not? I mean, if that's how you usually do reconciliation building, put people around a table, try to find out what they have in common. But maybe we could do part of that sort of through data analysis now.
I'm just wondering, because I'm not to be too negative, but...
please, not.
But
please don't.
But if the whole... I mean, if the attention economy is built like this, if the economic incentives are like this, that it promotes or it incentivizes anger, promotes anger, outrage... how it creates fundamental...
That's a theory.
And then, in my thinking, it doesn't create evil in and of itself, but it creates weaknesses that if you're an authoritarian or right-wing populist, it's much easier for you to use this because you feed on anger, you thrive on anger, and the people who want to reconciliate Israelians and Palestinians, they don't. So how do they use this to their advantage? I just don't...
One of the few things... No, it's a pretty glum situation. That's why we set up this sentence to kind of see what we can do. So I think I've read this somewhere. One of the few emotions that overcomes anger, and there's not very many, is awe, the sense that you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Religion.
Oh, crap. That's not... is that the only way we can get awe? I mean, there are other ways of it. There are other ways of doing it. But I think awe is...
I think awe
is defined as...
I'm a super secular person. I'm just saying.
You think you are.
Yeah, I think I am.
You just need a bit of awe in your life.
That's a different podcast.
Right. No, but I mean, I was quite surprised when I saw that as well. I didn't realise that was such a category, but apparently it is. So, yeah, we have to... So that's something to work with, giving people the sense... Well, not giving. Working with... The only way to overcome anger is working with the sense that you're part of something greater than yourself. That seems to be one of the few things that...
That's super... That's great. That's good news.
But there's, you know, there's ways of... I mean, that sounds very vague, but I think there are many ways of doing that through journalism. But...
You talked about the ideological crisis as well. So
yes.
Could you elaborate?
Yeah, sure. Of course I can. So, I mean, you can approach the whole post-factual problem that we've kind of been playing with purely from a digital, like a technical point.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
One of you, it's like the medium created this, but there's something else that's been happening. So especially, I think this is very clear when you look at the history of the Cold War and the nature of lies. So look, people have always lied and politicians have always lied, and that seems to be a big part of their job description. But the nature, something has changed in the nature of lies. So in the Cold War, when the Russians were trying to, for example, convince the West that AIDS had been invented by the CIA as a weapon, which was a the sort of full story they put out. They would go to great lengths to make that story seem real. So they came up with fake, well, actually real academics who planted this story. You know, they elaborated on the story for several years that it felt realistic. And when Reagan confronted Gorbachev with this, that this is a fake story the Soviets were putting out, Gorbachev was like, how dare you allege that I am lying? The Soviet Union would never lie. And today when Putin sort of goes up on TV, on international TV, and says there are no Russian soldiers in Crimea, as he did during the Crimea crisis, and kind of smiles. He knows that we know he's lying. And he's kind of saying, I don't care. You know, what are you going to do? Trump's like this as well. You know, he just lies for fun. And Putin's almost sort of wants us to go, but hold on. He also wants us to sort of accuse him of lying so he can point back and say, well, you lie too. You know, what's the big deal? So but so something's changed about the quality of lying. So Putin and Trump lie in a different way to, I don't know, Nixon and Gorbachev.
Also Kennedy probably lied. Also the left.
No, they all lied. I mean, yeah. Lying is part of the... No, we're talking about here about the what it says about our culture.
Yeah.
The truth doesn't matter anymore. This is slightly different to...
They don't try to even cover their tracks.
Exactly. But if you look back at the Cold War, I mean, both the Soviets and the Americans, they both had a rational project about making the world better. Both were trying to prove that their system was better. Was it capitalism or communism? Some, you know, communism we can now often think of as a sect and a cult, but it also had it was actually very much born out of an Enlightenment tradition. History, we're going somewhere, it's scientific, therefore we have to prove that what we're doing is right. Therefore the Soviets would constantly churn out these facts about their society, even though everyone knew it was bullshit, they still kept up the pretense. It was very important for them to carry on pretending that actually things were getting better.
So two ideas.
Yeah, but rational ideas.
Yes.
And facts you only really need when you have something that you want to prove. I mean, why would you need them? And I think facts are very tied to the idea of a future. I mean, you need facts when you're trying to get somewhere, when you're building a bridge, when you're doing something, when you're constructing something. You need facts as proof that what you're constructing is real. I mean, we don't have a post-factual
world. Engineering.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to bridges or something. So the quality of lies is because we were involved in two projects, both of which were deeply rational and had to prove something. And then in the 1990s, we kind of have one project left, Globalization, The Economist magazine. And again, look, the Russians are still pretending that they're liberalizing. They're still pretending that they have a democracy, even if it's bullshit. They're still pretending they have a market economy because it's important for them to prove that they are part of this great globalization process. And then 2008, that goes out the window. Nobody believes in that anymore. And so you're just left in this space where there are no ideals, nothing to head for. And then, like, there's this libidinal moment. Well, fuck the facts. I mean, it's quite nice to say there are no facts. There's a moment of rebellion in it. Facts, I think, to be very pretentious, are at the end of the day a reminder of mortality and death and limitations. You know, they're kind of like, they weigh upon you. And here you have this wonderful kind of moment where you throw off the weight of facts. And that's kind of the joy that I think Trump has. That's kind of the energy that he communicates.
That's a fascinating description, because it means that the Weltgeist, as we say in Germany, has not humor, but is very keen, at least, sort of to pick up the time to enter the stage.
So it's a carnival, basically, we're living through right now.
Yeah, we're living
a
carnival.
But it's a carnival, but it happens at the same time. At the same time, the myth of globalization collapses at the same time. In comes this fun machine,
this
disruptive rage machine at the same time. So that this is a perfect storm. It's the void is there, the stage is prepared, up come the clowns.
Perfect, exactly. I mean, I think it's for I've written. I don't know if you read everything that I read,
but we read more.
Yeah. But yes, no, and if you look at the sort of the sense of humor, a lot of these people, Duterte, Trump, and we've noticed this already, it's very it's right out of the carnivalesque, these sort of descriptions of sex and drinking and so on. It's a perfect storm, and I kind of let it be a perfect storm in my head. I suppose it's a complicated argument to make that, which I don't know if I believe it completely, is that, you know, that those narratives are also held in certain vessels, you know, in certain vessels of you know, media, and even as sort of like the media broke apart, that kind of meant that myth broke apart as well. So what I mean is, maybe globalization could have rebuilt itself if it was still two or three newspapers or something. But the fact there was so much
if the phantom world was still existing, which it is. So if that it's not a fake world, but it was an argument, as you say, it was built on economist perception of the world. So it was propaganda, basically. It wasn't fact.
It was an idea.
But it wasn't fact-based. It was, as sort of people that we talked to here said, it was, Lord Wood said, who was advising Blair at the time.
Brown and Miliband.
Brown and Miliband. Mm-hmm. So they really believed that there is no alternative to that. So it was religion. Globalization was religion. It wasn't fact-based. It was
an ideal. Yeah.
And more an ideal than an idea.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I grew up during that time. And definitely the sense that there was no alternatives. That, you know, there's various versions of this. Yeah, it was kind of very, very prevalent.
Could I try to make a question to both of you? Because I think there's techno-utopianism and there's techno-fatalism. And I'm curious about your perspective. Because the current argument seems to be in whatever enlightened or progressive or leftist circles or any circle. So it's, as you say, it's glum. It enforces negativity. And that's a super easy argument because everybody buys it at the moment. Is that a problem? Is that even true? Is that sort of one side of the argument? Is that sort of the cheap way to moan about the present?
No, I think, it is moaning about the present, but I do think it's true.
But it's not the whole story.
No, it's not. From my point of view, I think we need some kind of pushback. I mean, I think about this in political terms. And is it right that we have, isn't it strange that we have these two almost monopoly companies now completely controlling the information infrastructure that we all need for to be,
But you think it would be better if we
responsible
50,
citizens?
50 companies?
No, I think it would be better if we knew what the fuck they were doing and understood the mechanisms behind it, and that there were some pushbacks from consumers and politicians and governments, and that we because this is just not working. So I'm very, I'm short-term and...
We lost Peter here.
No, I'm just wondering. I mean, there's also this paradox that this sort of little engine of narcissism, if we buy that argument, and maybe there'll be research tomorrow saying it's bullshit, but at the moment there seems to be some agreement on that. At the same time, sort of every one of us gets to feel like a little Goebbels or like a little god in that little Facebook universe.
Yeah.
Is also the moment where data completely undermines the idea of the individual, and kind of like sort of there's this sort of paranoia that comes with it, that our data knows more about us than we do.
Yeah.
Might be connected.
Yes.
The surveillance data.
But also the psychographic stuff, you know.
You want to prove that you exist versus the micro data and the big data.
Well, you want to prove that you exist, but actually the more you do it, the more you have the sense that what if actually I'm not in control of all of this and my data is telling... But also the data is... And there's this guy at Oxford, I forget his name, he's got an Italian name. He's written a book called The Fourth Revolution and he compares data revolution to Freud and Copernicus, saying these are huge moments of sort of where we refashion the place of the individual in the world. So Copernicus, obviously, the Earth stopped being the center of the universe, Freud, consciousness stopped being the center of the universe, and now we realize that we're actually 80% data. And I think a lot of the stuff about sort of Cambridge Analytica and all those sort of fears around that is part of that sense that, oh my God, what if we've already said more about ourselves than we understand? I mean, I sometimes think back, how many traces have I already left? How much of myself have I already left out there? So apart from being very embarrassing, it's also kind of disturbing, you know. What if that knows more about me than I understand? So there's the anxiety could be around that as well. It's come here to take our souls.
Well, to ask you back, I mean, where's the optimism in this then?
Well, the optimism could still be in the combination between, as you say, the agency of people, aka the state or a government that's rational combined with the power of using data for an enlightened sense. So, of having a regime how to manage and control data in a democratic way, or the other sort of more optimistic view, and that sort of goes back to the question of ideology. So what is representative democracy really? It wasn't so clear, I think, for the last 250 years, or it was for the founders of the United States. but it wasn't so for the people living in Sweden, England, or Germany so actively, that it's a really distrust of the forces in the population of the people. That is representative democracy. So today the question is, could a more direct, not representative democracy also be happy, be good? So or is it as you say not able, because that's how people are? Was the distrust justified? You say negativity, everything feeds off negativity. That is the reason for distrust. People are destructive by nature. But is that true? And the argument, the only enlightened argument, I think, would be the assumption that no, that's not per se true.
Or is the answer.
well, listen, I mean, I was in Iowa recently, I spent a week there doing a lecture course at Grinnell. Do you know Grinnell? It's a tiny little town. So it's a town in Iowa. I'll be there for 10 days. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. I've never been to Iowa. And I'll take buses to the various towns and explore it. And I get there. I'm like, so where's the bus stops? I want to take buses in between sort of lectures I have to do.
You're basically doing a primary campaign.
Yeah, they were like, Peter, there's no bus stop here. There's no buses. And this kind of zen hits you, because, I mean, something about the Iowan countryside, it feels like waves, and the cornfields just go on and on, and you realize you can't get out. And I kind of feel this calm. Okay, I'm here for 10 days, I'm not moving, so what do? You watch TV all day. And it is incredible. I mean, not one strong local news channel.
Yeah.
All of it is somebody in LA, somebody in New York, lecturing you in a very, very, very kind of clearly incestuous conversation, and like 10 local weather channels. There's nothing about you, nothing that represents the Iowan. And of course you start to like Fox, because Fox are there, but they're the rebels there. So you kind of identify with them a little bit. So they're the bad boys in New York saying this is all wrong and rubbish. So that's the closest you have to finding some sort of surrogate feeling. So I would have become a Fox viewer there. I mean, the snobbishness of US elites. Oh my God, they deserve a kicking.
Yes. But
they really deserve a kicking.
There's this disconnect. We talked about that a lot, this disconnect, because you see the old regime in power, which is the monopoly of opinion, but there's all these ways to create that local community with this technology.
That's the bizarre thing, but then you come back to the economic incentives driving these, they are not built for people, despite what Mark Zuckerberg says, they are not built for people to come together around, you know, creating local communities.
But they are.
No, they are not. You can use them for that, but they are built for people to stay on the platform as long as possible so you can harvest their data. That's what they're built for.
So the model is that the user is the producer. So he's not knowing. He doesn't know.
I think
that
we need a different kind of infrastructure, but that's a big project.
What kind?
Something that is not that big and advertising based. I mean, that's the problem, no? I mean, it's all about harvesting data from people so you can sell advertising back to them. And I think that the countries and places in the world which has kind of withstood these new trends best is where you have strong independent media, maybe state-sponsored public media. So I just think you need... It's not the right infrastructure. It doesn't promote facts or community or coming together or, you know, reasonable discourse. It just doesn't. So we need to think about that. I don't know what the answer
you've
is.
You've talked about financial incentives quite a lot, and I think that's a huge part of it.
Yes.
So can we change the financial incentives? Can we make it unattractive for advertisers to sponsor fake news?
But isn't it an educational model? So, not an educational model, but you have to teach people that it's if you are on Facebook and you think it's free, it's not. So, wouldn't you be more autonomous if you pay a service or if you have sort of agency over that service as opposed to the other way around? So, you're just sucked into this world where you think you move in Google and you think it's a really weird assumption that people just build all these great tools for you just because they're so benevolent.
Yeah.
That's a huge fallacy, a global fallacy of how people and enterprises work. So you could sort of turn that around and say, you are the people, you own your tools, but you have to do something. You have to invest in those tools.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of also gets to the question of how and why do people consume things? So, but if we start from the idea that you're talking about people as innocent dupes who are so uneducated, they don't understand how they're being used.
That's how I see them.
No, so,
the idealist
so, in me. So, and yourself.
So does Orwell. I mean, you're a good company there. I actually, I mean, obviously, like, you know, we all grow up on, we all, in Britain, we grow up on Orwell and Shakespeare, and that's great. I think Orwell is probably wrong, though. I, in my experience, what I saw in Russia, where you have a, you know, is a very powerful propaganda state, is people know it's a lie, they just like it. So, and that seems to be like, that's only Quattrociocchi's research as well, that people are out there looking for fake stuff, they want it, and so if you don't start understanding why they want it and what's driving that and that really deep audience analysis, then we might be we might not find a fully powerful way forward.
Are you saying that the only way forward then is to have competing ideas again, competing ideologies, because that's kind of the way?
He says, I think people are dupes, and he says people want to be dupes.
What are you saying?
I think
it's not a contradiction.
It's
duping at the end. So there's no truth. There's no place for truth in that.
I think this is a really cheesy way of putting it, and certainly not mine. This was said downstairs in an event we had here at LSE. It's like, it's not about media literacy. It's about audience literacy. I think it's about understanding audiences. Why do they want it? I mean, in Russia, I want to understand why people are prepared to listen to these lies. Sometimes it's actually an authoritarian regime that's easier because it's often a threat. You know, we think Russians are stupid and believe everything that Putin says. They don't. It's a language. Putin's saying, this is what you have to believe if you don't want this to happen to you. It's a dance. It's not just here is the information and you're brainwashed by it. It's a lot of social levers, you know, and this is what happens to people who don't say they believe in this. There was a lovely bit of focus group that the Levada Center, who are one of the few sort of Russian independent sociology institutes, did, and they asked people, do you think there are Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine? And they're like, do you mean officially? So it's a game, you know. It's like people understand that it's a game, and they're not, I mean, there is a problem with the language we use around information. I mean, we often use the language of sort of viruses and sort of diseases, but it's not. I mean, I now have a very heavy cold, as you can probably tell. And this is a virus. Yeah. I picked it up from my kids because they went to fucking primary school. You know, I didn't want it. This is not a virus propaganda. It's a game. It's a dance. It's give and take. It's much closer to psychology. I don't know. But I don't think these kind of like, if only we can build up the immune system against the virus, we'll be fine. I think the metaphor is already, it has its uses, but it's not ideal. So basically, and we get that metaphor, of course, from Camus. So the first thing we have to do, get rid of Camus and get rid of Orwell, you know, because seriously, our ideas of propaganda are too much from these two geniuses. We have to move on.
To where? What's the next?
Well, Havel was much better. Havel's stuff on late Soviet Union was much better, about power of the powerlessness, about people who understand everything. Lisa Wedeen about...
Can you explain that, unpack that a little?
So, I mean, Havel's thing was people perfectly...
That's Havel's thing,
that people in late authoritarian regimes perfectly well understood that it was absolute bollocks, but they played along. Because that was a way of sort of like, you know, cementing your place in society, staying in. Lisa Wedeen has a terrific book about propaganda in Syria, not under this Assad, under Daddy Assad, where very educated people would repeat things like, Assad is the greatest chemist in the world, or dentist, he was a dentist. The greatest dentist in the world. I mean, they knew he wasn't. But again, this was part of the ritual that you played in order to show who you were in society, and the problem was, if you weren't to say that, you'd be killed. And that's why the younger Assad freaked out so much when these kids started doing this graffiti against him, you know, when the Syrian civil war started. You know, he went berserk about a bunch of kids, you know, graffitiing anti-Assad slogans, because they'd broken this very, very subtle compact in society where everyone knows it's bullshit, but you're not allowed to say it. And that was very, very dangerous. So he had to hyper-react to that. But those are authoritarian regimes. I mean, in America, you don't have any threats. In Britain, you don't have any threats. But still, people are doing it because it's some sort of dance. I think a lot of the Trump stuff is this sense of libidinal release. It's this like, woohoo, no facts, what fun. You know, he's overcoming death. In Britain, it's an obsession with exceptionalism. The Boris and Nigel Farage stuff played into that. I don't think it was about the 350 million.
But if you think about the metaphor of the carnival, I mean, the carnival always ends, no? I mean, you can't have a carnival forever. There's always this time of, like, waking up and there's a hangover and you need to kind
That's
of...
That's a very Swedish view of carnival.
Yes. No. Yes. Maybe.
Anyway, I didn't want to interrupt
you. How do you think about carnival? You can't have a carnival for... I mean, you can have a carnival for a while, and then you have to wake up.
That's a beautiful assumption. You're always assuming that it goes on. We come back to death again. So facts are death. So you ignore facts. That is the whole proposition of the carnival.
But don't people get tired of just, you know, having, like, Nigel Farage and... Boris Johnson making fools out of themselves eventually.
Well, do people get tired of sort of half-naked women dancing in Brazilian costumes? I don't know.
Are you talking about yourself now?
Never.
Half.
How other people might think about this.
I can really agree. I mean, again, not my metaphor. Somebody was talking about how reality catches up to people, and it's like a bull and a matador. You know, reality is this matador coming at us, and, like, you know,
Trump. So the bull.
Exactly. Sorry. Reality. Where's my metaphor set? Reality is the bull. And like, Trump and Putin are these matadors, kind of, like, you know, deflecting away from reality. And at one point, reality will catch up. But, like, yeah, historically, the record's not good. You know, you often have these bursts of unreality when a new medium appears.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, makes irrational forms of communication common. And, you know, so radio appears, empowers totalitarian ideologies. Print appears, helps catalyze the war's religion. So historically, the record is bursts of carnival and unreality, massive global conflict.
For 100
huge
years.
Huge death.
And then something new.
And then people are like, maybe we should use this in a more constructive way.
Yeah.
So reality does catch up. The question is, how vicious is the crisis going to be? So I think sadly, that seems to be the historical record. But maybe not. You know, maybe we've become less violent. I don't know.
As always, we want to definitely end on a cheerful note, so we have to really be... but because it's what you say, so there is. I mean, the record is bad, but it's not... the record is also good, because we overcame those hardships, wars. I mean, can you avoid...
100 years of war?
Yeah, but can you... Is that a fate? Is that really the fateful way that we have to go? Or is there... realizing that... That there is always a reshaping of truth, power. Can we anticipate that? Can we learn from totalitarian regimes, as you say? So, can we come up with a new paradigm for dealing with this big shift?
Carnival.
Give us something.
Well, the cynic in me says, yes, if we fund my little center.
But you have 18 months.
Yes, we have 18 months. And the historical record's pretty bad, huh? You're right. The thing that consoles me about social media is that its crises and ideologies are so superficial, and its fights are so superficial. I remember the first time I got into a fight on Twitter. And I was like, oh my God, this is so bad. Everyone's going to be talking about it. And I've lost so many friends. And then, like, people had forgotten for 3 hours because the next thing had happened. And there's something incredibly superficial about all these people. Even Putin, by the standards of Russian history, is a pretty rubbish dictator. So maybe there's something about the kind of the superficiality of all of it, which means that the crisis, though it'll feel very hysterical, will actually not be very bloody. Or we'll have robots fight it or something, you know. So maybe there's something so virtual about this virtuality. I mean, it's like, so the thing that worries me most about in America is not a lot of the kind of structural stuff that people are talking about. I think America's fine. It's young, it has computers and the dollar, you know, whatever. I think it's fine apart from the propaganda problem. So you now have a large part of the population who thinks that Hillary Clinton is a murderer, literally, or should be in jail. That's kind of scary.
That's the difference, though, also between the propaganda you were talking about before, where people could kind of unpack and think about, well, that's, you know, that's an official lie, and I have to say this because blah blah blah. Otherwise, I'm going to be affected by it. So that's, I mean, that's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, no, conspiracy. And this is Ivan Krastev's insight. Conspiracy is where ideology ends. You can't argue with conspiracy.
Yeah.
And conspiracy is a dividing line. It's about marking boundaries because you're either inside or outside the conspiracy. Mm. You can't. Exactly. So what's worrying America is now that America's become like Russia in the sense that I now spend the first 20 minutes in any conversation in America trying to work out whether the person lives in an alternative reality. Mm. And just very slowly, Seth Rich, what do you think about that? Mm. Yeah, she should be in jail. Okay, let's move on to football, you know. So it's a bit like Russia now. Like you have to kind of tiptoe around people working, you know, seeing where they exist. But on the other hand, is that a belief that people would die for? Do people really need that belief to exist? It's such a superficial bit of rubbish that I wonder, unlike communism, something else, Nazism, the people or now these days various forms of extremism. So on the one hand, it's disturbing that people live in this weird reality. On the other hand, you feel they could throw it away tomorrow as well. Like the story's bullshit and they could just do without it as well. So maybe the superficiality and silliness of all of this will save it.
That's a cynical argument, you say.
No, that was the positive one. That was the positive one. The whole thing is so meaningless. And it's like, so we've been monitoring the German elections. And it's so hard to sort of like keep a straight face. Because a lot of this whole stuff of Kekistan, you know, Kek.
Yeah.
And the whole mythology around it. Kek, the frog, and, you know, stuff. And then you go on these kind of like, you know, fake bot handles, which are spreading stuff in Germany. And it's a mixture of, to get attention, fruit that looks like penises next to kids in the Donbass being killed next to IFD. And it's just the whole thing is like some bizarre, very weird Dadaist experiment. And it's very hard to take, the alt-right too seriously. Of course we should, because, you know, Hitler probably looked ridiculous, whatever. But there's something so utterly silly about all of this. That maybe that will save it.
It.
Us. You know what I mean? But it's just like, you know, on the one hand, I find myself getting caught between kind of like, you know, thinking, oh no, this is such, all this stuff is so serious and bad. But, you know, humor is a dangerous thing. You know, humor can legitimize very nasty things and also kind of creates a space of chaos where there are no rules and lots of bad things can happen in those rules. In that space. But I don't know, even I find myself sort of sometimes going, are we really scared of Pepe the Frog? I mean, seriously, am I seriously meant to worry about this? Mm.
On that upbeat note.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't get to the whole idealistic perspective, but I guess that's
awe.
We'll meet after the
I'm
war.
Left and, with, I'm leaving this discussion with a sense of awe.
So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.